Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Are children people? Sounds like a joke question, but if you're a liberal, if you think politics is built on the equal moral worth of every person, kids create an immediate uncomfortable problem. Childhood is basically a legally sanctioned dictatorship. Parents can compel, restrict, punish, and control in ways that we would call authoritarian if they were applied to adults. My guest today is Rita Koganzan, an associate professor and political theorist at UNC Chapel Hill who studies education, childhood, and the family in political thought. She recently published a law review article at the Yale Law Journal that argued that students' rights discourse often functions as adult politics by other means, using children's voices to legitimate outcomes adults already want. We talk about what rights even mean for kids, whether more autonomy earlier is always progress, and why schools have become a central battlefield of liberal democracy. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Rita, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, when I turned 28 a few years ago, my social media feed, I guess, realized this because they're always watching us, and it turns into like mommy overdrive mode, right? For like any woman who's like scrolling on Instagram, etc. Mm-hmm. And I became exposed to a lot of these like debates that I think I hadn't really been aware of around, you know, whether timeout was abusive, the gentle parenting wars, like the distinction between gentle and permissive parenting, like when should you let kids do what they want, like when should you exert authority. And, you know, as someone who is, you know, knock on wood, hopefully closer to having kids than being a kid myself, it was like something I hadn't really spent a lot of time thinking about, like what types of authority I might like put onto my kid. Like I'd thought about things you want to do with your children, right? But you don't really think, I don't know, maybe other people did, but I didn't really think deeply about like when I would restrain their ability to do things that they might say they wanted to do. And I, you know, in my own work, I think a lot about liberalism and about rights. And it struck me as a place where I was like, I haven't really thought very deeply about whether or not the system of rights and rules that we are giving for adults, like how that should work for children who are like obviously not adults. And yet at some level, like, there are things that they want, there are things that they express and preferences that they have, and bad things that can happen to them as a result of having other people coerce them or other people exert authority over them. And I started reading more heavily about this field, which of course many, many people have thought about before for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I came across your work as a part of this. And I'm hoping we can sort of start somewhere, you know, like 50 years ago, when the kind of liberationist movement really kicked off, at least in the United States. Tell me about those folks who wanted to give children adult rights. Like, what were they thinking?
Well, they were thinking a very logical thing, right? Which is, you know, liberalism is a regime based on equality and liberty of all people. We are born with natural right to liberty, and we are born in equality, says Locke. And so, why would we have exceptions? And in the late 60s and 1970s, we had just gone through the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. And it was basically a time in which lots of people who had been accepted from the universality of liberty and equality had been brought into it, at least formally brought into liberty and equality. And so we started looking around for like other groups that may have been overlooked. And so these people found children. Children obviously are excluded from rights in a really significant way, and excluded from equality and excluded from liberty. And so if we just extend the logic of the civil rights movement, of the women's liberation movement, of all these other liberation movements of the late 60s, we might conclude that here is another group of a sort of oppressed people who have been unjustly denied their rights and to whom we ought to extend rights. And so that was the thought. And there were several figures in this movement. John Holt, Richard Farnham. Shulamith Firestone is the one I kind of like the best because she's writing also, I mean, she's part of the women's liberation movement and she sees the fate of children as tied up with the fate of women. And so in The Dialectic of Sex, which is like her most famous book, she has a whole chapter on children and the liberation of children. And she just says very explicitly, like, they're just another class of oppressed people. And in fact, they were invented in order to substitute for all the oppressed classes that had to be freed by the advent of liberalism, like the poor, so that we could have somebody to oppress because we like couldn't live without oppression. So that was their thought. Their thought was just the logic of extending rights, freedom, equality. We're doing it to everybody else. Why not do it to children?
This is something that struck me as very like obvious as a way of thinking. Like, you know, you start there, you're like, yeah, of course. And I think particularly many people who think about this remember times in their life when they were children and they felt constrained in ways they felt were unfair. Like, for instance, you know, I mean, it's a little trivial, but like I remember being in high school and, you know, having male teachers police what things girls were wearing in ways that I thought were unfair and unreasonable. And, you know, why would, you know, me distracting boys with a tank top affect anyone's learning? Like, you know what I mean? Things like this, which feel like you would never do this if I was an adult. It's not justified. The arguments you're making don't make sense. And also, I have no ability to even argue with you. There's no like court system where I could go like, well, I think that you're wrong and a reasonable adult would actually see things my way and we should change the rules. And so you have these experiences, but you also have other experiences. Like, I remember when I was like, you know, I remember being 13 and having kind of a sense like, oh, I'm basically the same as an adult. And then like later on in life realizing like, oh my gosh, like, no, I was not. I did not understand like the implications of the choices I was making. But I also feel that way, obviously, to a lesser extent about time when I was 18, when I was 22, when I was 23. And obviously, at some level, we just have to create institutions that can make decisions, even if there are imperfect bright lines that we're drawing. But it seems to me that we've maybe underexplored the ways in which children should access rights. And so the way that the liberationists really kind of, I guess, like kind of fell out of favor, in whatever small favor they were able to get, is that, you know, the problem is that if you say children are have equal rights to adults, you're also taking away the special protections that children have too, particularly when it comes to things like sexual abuse. So can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, you know, Firestone's arguments, John Holt's arguments, like they're of a piece with the kind of new left of the late 60s and 70s. And it all sounds great, like we should give children rights, until it comes to the fact that if we're trying to say that children should have autonomy, like adults have autonomy, well, adults have sexual autonomy. So how far do you want to go with children? And the great thing, bless their hearts, the child liberationists, they went all the way on the argument. But it was completely
they bit
logical.
The bullet.
Yeah, it was completely logical what they were saying, right? Which was like, what it means to be an adult is to have autonomy. That includes sexual autonomy. There's no way we can have a carve out for that. So that means that, you know, children, if we're going to say that they have a right to go get jobs, to make money, to make their own decisions about their lives, means that they can choose who to have sex with. And that might mean older adults, right? It might mean their parents, which, I mean, Firestone was willing to go there, right? If you're going to abolish the family, which is part of what she was arguing for, then we can't really tell people that they can't have sex with their siblings or their parents. So the incest taboo has to be dissolved. And pedophilia is something we would have to accept as the, you know, autonomous choice of children. If they want to have sex with like an older man, go for it. And that's when a lot of people like got off the train.
Got off the train, yeah. I don't think they should have bit that bullet. I think they should have been like, nope, actually, this
is
not.
So the good thing that they did, I mean, the you know, they're theorizing this, right? Especially Firestone. Mm-hmm. I mean, she has, it's, you know, a kind of utopian vision for a future in which we have liberated everybody, is that like the theory does lead there. And it's hard to theorize around that to say like, well, we're going to give children rights, but like not about sex. Well, why? What's wrong with children that they can't make their own sexual choices? Well, it turns out that we don't think they're mature, that they're not reasonable. Well, doesn't that then apply to all these other realms in which we've constrained them, that we've decided we're not going to constrain them in anymore? But there's the logic of autonomy applies to sex. It's hard to differentiate those or say that these are, you know, silo them off and say they're categorically different things. Mm-hmm. So I think they bring a lot of clarity to the argument.
Yeah. I don't hold this view, but I think that a lot of people would respond, no, I mean, sex is different, and that actually we should regulate adult sex differently as well. And for instance, like, I mean, there are people who are much more paternalist about what we should and shouldn't allow adults to do. And I mean, this is true to some extent. Like, for instance, there are people who want to, ban prostitution, who think, I mean, we have banned prostitution in most countries, but who think that that's correct and that we should go further about criminalization. There are people who think that it should be, you know, unacceptable to have surrogacy because it's a special kind and form of labor. So there are ways in which I think we do have, and porn, for instance, is a place where, of course, there's a huge push for regulation and to push against people's ability to commercialize sexual conduct more broadly. And so there are ways in which I think that, you know, there's a way to be consistent about this that would still allow children to have rights. And I wonder how you think about those arguments.
I don't know that you can really do that. I mean, you're right to say we regulate sex in lots of ways. We regulate largely public sex. But private sex is a lot harder to regulate. So, you know, you can't sell your body on the street. But if, like, you were, you know, in some kind of private relationship and you took money in exchange for sexual acts, like, there's no way to prosecute that. And so, you know, in the basic foundation, too, in liberalism is there's a kind of, you have individual choice. So it's true, your choice may not extend to having 10 spouses, but you get to choose the spouse that you have because you have to consent to marriage. Mm-hmm. And so your parents can't just marry you off against your will. Well, if you're able to consent to that, then we have to extend whatever right we're going to give to adults, we have to extend to children if we're accepting an equal rights kind of framework, right? Because any way that we distinguish them, where we say, look, if you're over 18, you can choose any spouse, right? If you're under 18, we're going to regulate that. Then already we're distinguishing minors from adults, right? So I think the sex problem is a really key to understanding why we can't have children's rights in the way that might seem desirable in other spheres, because we can't differentiate. And even if we say, well, you can have the right to hold a job, let's say 16-year-olds, they have a right to hold a job. I mean, in the sense that they're allowed to be employed, you know, that it's still like attenuated. So long as we don't give you sexual rights, because sexual rights are really essential. Like, they come up even in Locke's second treatise. There's conjugal, you know, society is formed in the state of nature and you have to consent. He says it's a voluntary contract. So when you're a minor, you can't consent to that. And if we're going to say that that's part of what constitutes adulthood is the ability to consent to marriage, then we can't withhold that from minors if we're serious about making them equal.
So is this your what gets you off the train of trial liberationism, or what makes you kind of opposed to it?
I was never on that train. I think it's a really interesting argument, and I think it illuminates a lot about liberalism. Like, it's really important for people to make crazy arguments and like go all the way on things like, you know, we should abolish incest, whatever. Like, somebody should make that argument. We shouldn't do it. But I think because making that argument illuminates the logic that underlies why we have these prohibitions in the first place, right? If nobody wants to touch it because it's so taboo, then we don't really understand why we're doing what we're doing. So I think that child liberationists are really useful for understanding why we don't give children rights. But I would get off the train much earlier. I would get off the train at sort of an understanding of why we have an age of majority in the first place, why it's arbitrary but necessary. And then I think that sort of gets at why we find it frustrating, but also it also illuminates why we have to swallow it.
But does it implicate to you? No, but to me, where my article on this topic really, really focused on it, that I kind of feel like liberalism this is a fundamental problem for liberalism, that it can't provide individual rights to children. The solution is not, I don't think, giving kids equal rights as adults, but I also don't think that there's like a quote-unquote liberal solution to this problem. There's just, I guess, practical ones, given the fact that children don't have the same capacities as adults do. So how do you think about this? Do you think it's just like liberalism can't actually provide a framework that is both consistent and fair to children?
I think it's fair to children to have no rights. That's what I would argue.
Okay.
I think that is fair. And that's actually very important to liberalism, that we maintain this distinction between child and adult, minor and adult, because if you think through Locke's arguments and why he says something like, children are not born in equality, but they're born to equality, right? Well, why? What is it that makes us capable of sort of like putting on the equality that is our sort of inheritance? What makes us capable of being citizens, of being self-governing? And it's reason, because the law of nature is reason. And if you don't know the, if you don't have reason, then you can't know what the right thing to do is. You can't know how to follow the law of nature. So it turns out that to be a liberal citizen is something that you achieve and not, is not something that you're immediately born into. And so once we, once that's the premise, that reason is the basis of our ability to be free, then we have, in a sense, hived off this group of people who we can't allow to be citizens because we see that they're obviously unreasonable, right? And that starts with infancy. Like, if you've ever seen a baby, that's like the least reasonable thing you've ever encountered. It can't do anything for itself. Like, once they can start to do things for themselves, they just do totally self-destructive things, right? They're just like walking to the street into traffic. They fall off of everything. It's just like, you know, self-destruction. They have like the death drive for a while. So obviously that's not reasonable because self-preservation is the most reasonable thing. And it does not appear that most toddlers are very self-preserving. So we see a kind of visceral problem here that like there's this subgroup of people. We all start out that way too. It's not just like this is a permanent group and they're just like that and the rest of us are better. No, like we all start out with this incapacity. And so it turns out that liberalism in some way hinges on achieving a capacity that we don't have at birth. And we need to draw the line somewhere. And that's, I think, where a lot of the frustrations and the contradictions and the problems arise, which is like, where do we draw the line and how do we draw it? How do we determine that people are reasonable? Well, we could like, I mean, one of the problems I think everybody sees, like when I teach this to my students, they immediately see this, right? It's like, there are some 10-year-olds who seem to be like better able to manage their lives than some like 40-year-olds, right? I mean, think about like drug addicts, think about people who just like can't seem to hold it together, right? There obviously are kids who could do better than that. So on the one side, we have early maturity for some kids, like 18 doesn't seem to be the age at which some people get mature. They get mature much earlier. And then we have on the other end, the problem of people who are way older than 18 and are totally immature, right? And so like, why 18, right? Why don't we just kind of make people into citizens, liberate them at the point at which they individually achieve reason? And that would seem to be fair and to solve some of these problems, right? That it's not fair to constrain people who have demonstrated reasonableness. And at the same time, it's not really a good idea to liberate people who have not demonstrated reasonableness. But the danger there is somebody has to administer the test, right? And who's going to be doing that? Who's in charge of determining, of judging when you are reasonable, right? Well, it's going to be the government. The government doesn't have a lot of incentive to deem you reasonable ever. And that's what Locke is arguing against. I mean, he's arguing against absolute monarchy. That's like the sort of thing that's hanging in the background of his argument. He's arguing against Robert Filmer. And he sees that if we're going to say that reasonableness is individually attained at different points by individual people, we've got to give somebody the authority to decide. And the person, the whatever, the entity that we're going to give this authority to, it's not going to have a lot of incentive to make people free. Because the government wants to rule. Right? Whoever is in charge, they want to rule. And so they're just going to decide that as many times as you take that test, you failed it. It's like going to the DMV, except the DMV is the sovereign. And the DMV just says like, nope, not a good enough parallel parking. Nope, you didn't really look when you turned there. I saw that. They'll find reasons, right? And you'll never get that driver's license. So you'll never get your adult license either. So the age of majority is the solution to that problem. It's arbitrary. I mean, it's not totally arbitrary. We don't set it at 3 and we don't set it at 80, right? But like within some range of late adolescence, early adulthood, it's pretty arbitrary. It could be 19, could be 20, 21, you know, 25 even. You could imagine that. Wherever we set it universally, right? And that way we don't give anybody discretion over whether somebody has reached the age of reason and is now a citizen. It just happens. And like the language even that Locke uses to describe the age of majority is really revealing because he says, we presume you to be reasonable at that point, or we suppose people are reasonable at that point. He himself does not suggest anybody's actually reasonable. He just says like, this is a presumption, but it's a kind of key to freedom because if we don't have this presumption, if we allow some kind of discretion for somebody somewhere to decide who has made it to reason, we have tyranny, right? So for him, that's the line between tyranny and freedom.
And I think I want to drill in on what reason means here, right? Because I think at some level, people hear that word and they can think it means you're going to make good choices. Like, you wouldn't fling yourself into traffic. But that's not true, right? People can make choices that I think are, like, bad all the time and still have achieved, like, the reasonability that you're talking about here. And I think that this is what makes it hard, because even in a theoretical world where there was some, like, completely benevolent operator, right, that was deciding whether or not someone was reasonable enough to enter the realm of being, like, a liberal citizen, right, like, I'm not really clear on what that actually means, because there are some adults who I think are making choices that are very, I mean, not just drug addicts, but just, like, even at a less, biophysical level, like at a level of you are making bad financial decisions that are going to lead you to be in poverty in like 50 years. Or like all the things that we're worried about with kids, where they'll make bad financial choices, bad educational choices, bad sexual choices. Like, there are,
as I tell my students, my college students, yeah, it's what you're doing on Friday night. Right. That's not reasonable.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, even throughout adulthood, even people we consider very reasonable people will make choices that could devastate their lives, the lives of others, in ways that were like, this is like an irrational decision that you had. And even they themselves will go, and I don't know why I did something like this. So what are we saying when we say someone is reasonable?
Well, what Locke is saying is pretty minimal in a sense. He says, well, it's enough to know the law of nature. Well, what's the law of nature? It's the understanding that you can't harm anybody in their life, liberty, or property, and that they have rights to life, liberty, and property just like you. So there's a kind of golden rule element of it that Kant like extrapolates much further later on. You understand that you have a right to self-preservation and a right to life, liberty, and property, and therefore everybody else does too. And it's, and the law of nature prohibits you from harming them. And once you can realize that, that's his criterion for reason. But again, he never describes what it would be like to realize that. He just says, like, you have to draw an age, pick an age. It's a presumption. Once you're there, everybody gets admitted. And he makes a couple exceptions. He calls them lunatics and idiots. This is the phraseology of the 17th century. Lunatics, idiots, and madmen. They can never, madmen go in and out of reason. He says, like, sometimes they're reasonable, sometimes they're not. And then lunatics and idiots just, we expect them to have a guardian for their whole lives, essentially. So there are some kind of cognitive disabilities that he sees as possibly with, you know, withholding citizenship. We can withhold citizenship from these people. But he doesn't go into any detail about how you would know or whatever. It seems self-evident. Like, this is a very small percentage of the population. We would know if somebody is a lunatic or an idiot, right, in his terminology. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to think that hard about that. But everybody else. So the bar seems pretty low, right? Can you understand that self-preservation is your natural right? Can you understand that if you're to be free and equal, everybody else is free and equal, and you can't harm them in their life, liberty, and property? Will you sometimes do it? Yes, you will. That does not preclude doing it. It just is an understanding that you shouldn't.
I think that there's a lumping problem often when we think about children's rights, or we think about rights in our autonomous rights as adults extend to every single sphere of our life, essentially. But with children, there are ways in which we could expect, like, okay, well, yes, you're not an adult, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't have the right to speech. Or maybe it says you have the right to freedom of association, or you have, you know, there are ways in which you could imagine, like, okay, that would restrict certain kinds of rights. But the kinds of things that we take away from kids is, or that we don't grant to kids, or we don't recognize that kids have as natural rights, go far beyond that. So how do you think about that? Like, do you think it would be a better world if we were to grant certain kinds of rights to children, but not others?
So I think it's a kind of semantic question that you're getting into. So we wouldn't grant the rights to children. We could give freedoms. So for example, like, there's two ways of thinking about children's rights. I found this useful. I didn't come up with it, but it's a useful kind of heuristic, which is there's liberatory rights and there's protective rights. And so protective rights are like, you have a right not to be forced into employment as a minor. You have a right not to be abused or neglected as a minor. And then the question becomes, well, how do we enforce those rights? Because the child himself can't enforce those rights, right? Well, the state steps in, right? That's how we do it. We say, like, the state, you know, somebody, you know, you look like maybe you're abused. We have some reason to suspect that. The state steps in. They go to your house. They do an investigation. They might take you away from your family, right? And that's a way of upholding your right to be free from abuse or neglect, right? So some adult is coming in and adjudicating the question of whether your right has been violated, right? And children, like, can't sue on their own even. They might have standing, but they need, like, a guardian to sue on their behalf. So if we say, well, there's these rights where we protect children from certain kinds of adult abuses, right? And then the state is the sort of enforcer of those rights, usually against parents. Then there's another way of thinking about children's rights, which is liberatory rights, like the right to free speech, which is the one you mentioned, right? The idea of the right to free speech, so when you say you have a right not to be abused or neglected, you're not saying I have a right against all adults. You're just saying I have a right against whichever adults are in charge of me right now, that they have to treat me in a certain way. Otherwise, I will be put in the care of other adults who will treat me better. When we talk about like First Amendment rights or freedom of speech or something like that, we're saying I have a right against all adults. I have a right to speech, right? And I have a right to say or write or whatever what I want, and no adult can stop me. There's something paradoxical about that, right? And if you look at the Supreme Court cases that deal with this, like you kind of see the paradox. So like free speech case like Tinker v. Des Moines is decided in 69. It's like the famous case that says, you know, you don't leave your First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse gate. You're allowed to have free speech in the schools. Well, how would we vindicate that right? Right. I mean, how is this case decided? You have these kids, the Tinker family, their parents bring the lawsuit on their behalf against the school. If you look at these other cases, Pico v. Island Trees is a right to read case. So it's about book censorship in the schools. Pico is supposed to be like one of the students in the high school. It's brought by adults. Right. Like the kids kind of get, you know, they're like kind of chess pieces. They're pawns in these games that adults are playing. Adults are the ones who think like you shouldn't censor books in the school. Right. Mm-hmm. Children have no access to the books on their own. Right. They don't order the school library's books. Some adult does that. And then if some other adult says like, I think this book is, you know, inappropriate for students, then it's a contest between adults. The adults that order the book and the adults who think it's inappropriate. And we just like pull the kids in and we say like, see, this kid, they want to read the book. They have a right to read the book. The kid never requested the book. The kid would not know the book existed but for adults. Right.
But isn't that true of like all libraries? Like I don't order the library books at my local library. I just kind of go there, you know?
Right. Well, but so to say, you could ask the library, like, I want this book. Why'd you take it out? Mm-hmm. The students don't really do that because adults control, for minors at least, adults control their access to all this material, right? So some adult would have to say like, you want to read this book? And then they could say, yeah, I mean, that could be their genuine desire after they hear about the book, right? Like, ah, I want to read Harry Potter. That looks interesting. Oh, these people think like witchcraft is Satanism or something. They want to ban it. So, I mean, there is the element of like real authentic desire maybe, but it's kind of instilled by adults there. And that's true in like all of these cases. It's not the case that children don't really put themselves up to this stuff. It's adults on the one hand. It's, oh, and in these like students' rights cases, it's usually like parents versus the school district. And there's just competing views of what a correct education is. So there's something paradoxical about vindicating rights that are against all adults for minors who can't actually do that themselves ever. Mm-hmm. Whereas these protective rights, I mean, they raise problems about like, where's the line between the state and the parents? And it's not simple, but it's still more logical because you're basically saying, yeah, the child has the right, but some adult somewhere always has to, you know, vindicate it for them. They don't have a right against adults. They have a right to a certain kind of upbringing, which some set of adults may not be providing for them. So I think that's one useful way to think about it. Yeah.
Maybe you can draw the paradox for me a little bit more, because in my sense, I mean, obviously, to some extent, all of our desires could be characterized how you're characterizing desire in children. Like, for instance, like, would I have ever known about any book that I enjoyed if it hadn't been someone who recommended it to me or someone who had placed it somewhere? Like, those desires are placed and are shaped by other adults, other people, and other institutions that I have no control over or very little control over. And so it's not really clear to me why it's paradoxical that children are, you know, naturally coming across ideas that they did not, you know, come up with on their own. Like, I didn't come up with Harry Potter on my own, you know?
Yeah, well, they're not naturally. There's some adult, like, ordered them for the library. So I guess for you as an adult, like, when you can say, like, the public library book banning is like a whole different problem, right? Which is like, yeah, somebody else picks the books that the public library orders. But you can also request things in a way that it's not really available to students to like stock their own library, like under any circumstances. They don't decide the curriculum of their school, right? So they can't say like this book should be taught or not taught. They're just not in a position to do that. And if we were to be serious about like something like a right to read, we would have to radically reorganize education, right? Mm-hmm. So I think when people are talking about things like a right to free speech or a right to read for children, they think this is like something you could do easily and surgically. Like you could just let children publish whatever they want in the school newspaper. But like, no, actually, if children really had these rights in school, they would have to have some authority over the way the school is run, the school curriculum. That's the way to actuate these sorts of rights, because otherwise mm-hmm. they're just kind of the playthings of different groups of adults who have different partisan agendas and are basically like holding up the kids whenever they want to get something done. There's a nice quote in some article I read recently about how it was like somebody from Saudi Arabia who had come to study in the United States. And he was like, it's really interesting because in Saudi Arabia, when we think things are immoral, we just say they're immoral. And in America, when they think things are immoral, they say it's bad for the children. But that's and, right.
Yeah.
So we, it's bad for the
like,
children.
I wonder though, to me, what I'm hearing though is like, I think it seems less difficult maybe than you do to include children in the way that we decide curriculum. Like for instance, my home county, Montgomery County, Maryland, has had a student member of the Board of Education for a long time that's elected from all the high school students in the county. This is not given the same rights as every other member of the Board of Education, but like it seems very plausible that you could just give that person that student the same rights to do that. They're not doing it for reasons I think of they're worried about the politics shifting on the board or whatever. But you know, I could imagine that happening, and then there's now a political voice that is elected by the students, high school students, and like able to make decisions about curriculum in the same way that adults are able to vote for members of the Board of Education. And it seems like that would not actually be that huge of a deal to allow that to happen.
Yeah, well, so that also wouldn't structurally change anything. What you should think about is more like very progressive schools that have, I mean, there are schools that are designed on this idea of like student democracy, right? That like mm-hmm. the best way to train citizens for a democracy is like to give kids like the ability to make these decisions. So obviously, like, we can't change the whole constitution when they're not going to run for the House or the Senate, but we could have a school where they have significant autonomy. And the great example, like the 1970s, this is the great decade for all this experimentation, Summerhill is this like school in Britain. This guy A.S. Neal writes a book about it, and all these Americans read it and they're like, this is amazing, let's all do this. And it's basically a school run by the students. And so can you imagine such an institution? Of course, like it doesn't take, we have very decentralized, deregulated schooling. You can set up basically any kind of school you want, right? Could we have a school where the children run the school? Yeah, absolutely. How many parents are going to send their kids to that school?
Very few.
Yeah.
But I don't get why it needs to go to, maybe this is, I'm missing something here, but I don't get why it needs to go to that extent. Like, why isn't it possible to have, like the absence of adults is not necessary for students to have their rights.
To make sure you don't kill yourself and stuff.
But even just, like, including adults, and like, for instance, my rights as a woman are not necessary to eradicate men at the workplace. Like, why is a child's right to accessing, you know, free speech or freedom, a right to read, necessitate adults' exclusion from decision making?
No. I mean, Summerhill is a kind of extreme version, and there are adults there; they're involved. But like to say, well, you have to restructure the school in such a way where there's real student participation, robust student participation in real decision making, like the curriculum, right? Like the disciplinary processes, like all of these things. Well, what would that mean? So you have a student member of the Board of Education. This person probably has like very truncated capacities to make decisions. And also they're one of whatever, a larger number of people, nine, I don't know, whatever the board is, right? So what would it mean to give students really substantial say in the school curriculum? How would students know what should be in the curriculum?
I mean, maybe this is part of why I'm so open to it, is that my work in local government is like my work, like these processes and the people making decisions are making them in such ridiculously bad ways already. It's like not really clear to me that it's great. So, I mean, we know this from the book banning stuff, right? That like there are very small numbers of people who are hijacking these processes in order to ban books. I think, I don't remember what the number was, but like almost all of the books banned in Virginia, for instance, were banned by just a handful of individuals just making these requests in a bunch of different locations. And like local governments are very easily hijacked by individual people who are not really representative of the views of everyone. I mean, Montgomery County, I mean, to kind of extend this, like some student member of the board proposed redrawing the school boundary lines because students end up being more progressive, I think, than their parents are. And they're realizing there are a bunch of racial and class inequalities. And they bring up a proposition to like study this. And so they bring this to the student, the board. The board votes in favor of a study of the school boundary lines in Montgomery County, Maryland. And then what happens is that a large number of parents are upset because they're like, okay, we bought our homes in areas where we wanted good schools to exist, and we don't want these school boundary lines redrawn to help lower income and Black and brown students. That would really piss us off because we made these massive investments. And people saw this as like, oh, this is a Democratic upswing. But when you look at the numbers, it was a very small number of parents who managed to basically override the preferences of not just the students, but also potentially a large number of other parents and students in the entire county who would have benefited from this redrawing. And so to me, part of why I'm so like kind of blasé about the idea of student engagement here is that like the decisions being made in school boards across America are like often nonsensical, terrible, and like not that good for students.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you structure local government too. Like there's not a lot of turnout, there's not a lot of participation in local government. So intense minorities, that's like what political science would call it, right? Intense minorities just get their way because they're the only people who show up. So you could say, well, that's a problem of institutional design for local government. But I would say like for your question, what you really want to think about is like, what would it mean for students to design the education? Not just to like, you know, veto or affirm, you know, should we use these textbooks or that textbook? Because that's a lot of what the school board does. I mean, they don't really design the curriculum from scratch. They kind of police the curriculum from above as it already exists. But imagine what it would mean to say that like, we're going to allow students to design the curriculum, to select the books that are going to go into the library. Like imagine a 10-year-old. How would they do that? They don't know what they don't know. So how are they supposed to know what they need to learn, right? I mean, the presumptions underlying education are like, there's this group of people who know things, and then this group of people need to learn the things. And it would be preposterous to ask the students who don't know the things what they're supposed to know and how they're supposed to learn them. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not that students can't have preferences like I hate this teacher. I like this teacher. I like this person's pedagogy. I don't like this person's pedagogy. But a lot of that is reactive. Right. First, you have to experience it. Then you make a judgment about it. It would be much harder to ask them to design it in advance. Now, I think the high school point is really salient to this problem of the age of majority, which is like, yeah, there are 16-year-olds who probably would be pretty good on a school board. Right. Like in an absolute sense, they would be like good, responsible, thoughtful members of a school board. Probably not a lot of 8-year-olds, but 16-year-olds, right? So then the question just becomes, where are we drawing this line? Mm-hmm. And we get frustrated with where we've drawn the line because we can think of exceptions on both sides and say like, well, what about, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is we've got to just draw the line somewhere. And we have to understand when we're doing it that like the smart, mature, reasonable 16-year-old has been unjustly excluded. But it's not really unjust because the age of majority is justice, even though there's an arbitrariness to its justice.
Yeah. I think that part of what makes me uncomfortable about this sort of thing is that the way that I think about democracy is often not, do I think that you have gained relevant expertise or understanding in order to make decisions? Like when I think about how people make decisions about from like a, you know, we're keeping on the education side, when I think about how they make decisions about what good schools look like, whether they're voting for you know, school boards, whether they're engaging in their local school, they're showing up to, you know, parent teacher conferences or meetings or whatever to engage in the kind of governance that's non-political that goes on at the school level. They're often making decisions in ways where I'm like, this is not with a lot of understanding of whether phonics or whole language is actually best for your students. You don't have any like relevant expertise there, but this is true in all areas. Like you don't have relevant expertise about healthcare. You don't have relevant expertise about, you know, law. You don't have relevant expertise about criminology. And yet we have to like, because, you know, the foundational understanding of democracy is that these people are providing their preferences in ways that representatives can understand and then implement, and then people will vote them out if they don't like it. And so to me, it's like, yes, I agree that this is more so of a group of people that has less comprehension or capacity to comprehend these complicated issues and topics. But that's not really why I let 18 to 90 year olds make decisions about education and housing to begin with. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, expertise is a more complicated question, right? And I think that is a little bit orthogonal to this point, right? So it's not so much even that the students don't have enough expertise to set up a school. It's that they don't know even what they need to know about the world, right? Because they haven't learned it yet. So it's not so much about like whole language versus phonics or other, you know, pedagogical approaches or something like that, but just in a really basic sense, like imagine an 8-year-old designing a curriculum, right? Mm-hmm. design, you know, imagine them designing that curriculum, like going forward into high school, you know, whatever you think education should terminate. There seems to be some kind of problem there, right? That even though many adults are idiots, we just don't see it as much of a problem. Like somehow it's true that many people are silly, foolish, partisan, you know, partial, selfish, etc., whatever these bad qualities that all human beings have. It seems like we think that the curriculum, broadly speaking, designed by adults is suitable for children in a way that it's hard for us to imagine an equally suitable curriculum arising out of a committee of eight-year-olds or even a mixed committee of eight-year-olds and adults, let's say, where at least the eight-year-olds had some serious, you know, input into what was going on. And so I think that's, and then the question is like, where do you draw the line? We get back to this problem of the age majority. Maybe we should push the age of majority back. Maybe it should be 17. Maybe it should be 16. There's all kinds of proposals like to let 16-year-olds vote, right? I mean, that's not crazy. But that's just a kind of practical question. It doesn't get at the principle, which is that somewhere there's a demarcation. And that demarcation is arbitrary and yet totally just because we can't really have liberalism without it. And so then there's these other questions, like you say, like the practical points, like, couldn't we allow children to do things? That's kind of like the free range kids stuff. Like Lenore Eskenazi is very involved in this sort of thing. Like, you know, couldn't we allow children to like walk by themselves places, right? Or like go to the grocery store and pick up milk for their families or like without somebody calling the cops and being like, why is this child unsupervised? And I think that that's totally within the, I mean, it's totally reconcilable with liberalism, but you can't think of that as children's rights. That's parents' rights, right?
This what is exactly what I'm, yeah. Yeah, this is actually where I want to go next because this idea of parents' rights, what does that mean? What does it mean that a parent has rights?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, if we're kind of going forward from Locke, right, this is kind of Blackstone, who's a Lockean, he's kind of articulating the common law. And his argument is like, well, parents have obligations, and this is also in Locke, right? Parents have obligations to nurture and educate their children. And they have whatever kind of rights are necessary to that end. But mm-hmm. children are not the property of parents. And Locke is very careful about this, that like these rights that parents have, to the extent that we could even call them rights, are almost all obligations to like for the purpose of their children's good, not for their own good, although they conveniently converge at some point. So when we talk about parents' rights, we're talking about like what is it what is necessary for parents to be able to discharge these common law obligations of nurturing and educating their children. Right, which requires some degree of discretion on their part over how they're going to do it. You know, parents' rights are not like a constitutional principle. I mean, there are a lot of people who argue for them on constitutional grounds, but they're not actually in the Constitution. And so it's really ambiguous. And then the flip side of this common law obligation to nurture and educate your children is like, if you don't, who's going to step in? And that's where the state comes in, right? So there's a kind of built-in conflict between the state and parents because the rights of parents are actually obligations. Mm-hmm. And in order to ensure that those obligations are carried out, some third party has to exist that could adjudicate whether they're being carried out. And typically, that's the state. Now, the state could be the local government. It could be the state. It doesn't have to be like some Leviathan, some kind of like centralized thing. But at some point, there has to be some third party. Mm-hmm.
And I think about this in the context of the article that I wrote was about how much our limiting of child autonomy is a limit on parents or a parent's ability to access existing rights that they have, right? So, for instance, you know, a parent is just an adult. An adult has, well, we should hope, parents are largely adults, and they have rights over to rights to freedom of religion and freedom of speech, etc. And there are ways in which, I mean, people really react negatively to when they feel like children are being indoctrinated by their parents, right? On the right, they're upset when they see children being brought to political rallies. They're like, why would you bring your child to, you know, this protest of ICE or to this, you know, the Women's March, whatever. Like, this just seems like a really bad thing and like an unfair thing to do to them. On the left, there's disgust when we see, you know, those children at the Westboro Baptist Church protests, or we see at abortion clinics, children standing with like pretty vile signs or pretty graphic signs. And this is a place where I wonder here, like, Are we saying that in order for, I mean, in many cases, in order for a parent to be able to go to that protest themselves, they probably would need to either bring that kid along, or you're saying that they have to like pay out of pocket for childcare in some case. And so is the reason that we like allow that kind of potential harm to happen to those children? Because there have been harm that done to children in these cases, like children harmed at these protests, or even just engaging in this can be very, very psychologically damaging if you're at a, you know, at an abortion clinic and yelling at people going in. And so are we allowing that harm because it is needed in order to allow parents to exercise their rights? Or is that something where you think our current institutions are failing to protect children?
I don't know that bringing your kids to a protest is like in principle a form of harm. And, you know, in fact, the thing that comes to mind that, you know, this was sort of intensively debated in the 80s and 90s about indoctrination is fundamentalism, mm-hmm. is religious fundamentalists, right? I mean, do fundamentalists exist? I don't really know. But certainly, like, the left seemed to think that they did in the 80s and 90s as, like, some kind of distinct branch of Christianity. And their argument was like, well, these parents who are homeschooling their kids, right? Like, they're not even sending them to school. So homeschooling is one example of this question of, like, is this abuse? Because now you're not, they're, you know, forcibly preventing them from being exposed to the larger society. They're teaching them their religious views. They're taking them to their church, which espouses those same views, and they're not allowing them to have any kind of exposure to alternatives. Like, mm-hmm. isn't that a clear case? It seems in some ways a more clear case of indoctrination because you're literally like taking away all of the alternatives. Well, can we allow that? And that was one of the huge questions that comes up in the homeschooling debate. Like, why should we allow homeschooling when it's just facilitating this kind of indoctrination? It's like the home is also the school that's, you know, replicated by the church, reinforced by the social circuit. Just everything that you encounter is your parents', you know, intense worldview. Isn't that indoctrination? Should that be allowed? And I would say, like, yes, it should be allowed. We don't have a good alternative to that. Maybe it's not ideal. I don't even know if it's not ideal. I mean, I think that a lot of the sense in which like this is indoctrination is overstated. Mm-hmm. People who are minorities, like minority religions or whatever, like they live in this majority country where it's really hard not to notice the majority, like by virtue of being the minority. And so, you know, you always feel that you're up against something and that something is there and it's big. And it's everywhere. Like your parents are trying to protect you from it. You see them trying to protect you from it because you see that. Right. Like you see mm-hmm. that it's there. So, yeah, I think a lot of it is a kind of wager that we're making. Right. That like the alternative to allowing parents this freedom is a lot worse than the bad outcomes that might come out of allowing parents this freedom. Like one of the bad outcomes of homeschooling is like you can abuse your kids without anybody noticing for a long time. If you mm-hmm. had sent those kids to school, at least some other people would see them sometimes. Right. And like, could maybe find out if something was going on in their house. You know, guarantee, obviously lots of abuse happens to kids who are going to school and nobody notices that either, right? Mm-hmm. But like, there's some sense in which like the chances for it to be discovered are a little bit greater. On the other hand, if we took away this right, like we would also be taking away many of the good things that come from families who are not abusing their children while they're homeschooling them, right? Who are actually really enriching their children or providing them with something that a school can't provide them with, right? Because a school by definition is a big institution, et cetera. So I think this is just, you're kind of making a bet, right? You're saying, well, what's more likely? Are we more likely to get more abuse or more good things? And this mm-hmm. is like, there's a principle involved, which is this principle of parental rights and parental sort of decision-making and discretion about how to raise their kids. But that principle is never absolute in any liberal regime because there is this obligation, which always implies somebody could come in and say, no, you're not holding up your end of the bargain. So where we draw that line is kind of up to us. And we have to decide like what is more likely to happen? And I think like with homeschooling, that's like a partisan issue where the left hates it and the right likes it, right? And I would say like the left is kind of wrong in where they've drawn, where they think that the odds are going to hash out. That most mm-hmm. parents, we have to presume, want what is best for their children and are going to not try to harm them. Even though inevitably, yes, we will have like instances of abuse. And we will say like, that's on us because we allowed this to happen. The flip side is we make everybody go to school. And you have to ask a question, which is like, how is that not bad for some people who really like have a hard time handling, you know, the world of school and mm-hmm. are really damaged by being forced into it, you know? And you can think of like, everybody knows kids who just like really didn't come out that well from the experience of school. Mm-hmm. So there's just costs on both sides, right? people are different. They benefit from different kinds of contexts. Sometimes you have parents who understand what's good for you. Sometimes parents misjudge. Sometimes parents don't even consider what might be good for you. They send you to school when they shouldn't have. They homeschool you when they shouldn't have, right? But like, there's costs on either side. And it's just a matter of weighing which costs we're willing to swallow. And one way or another, you're going to have blood on your hands. Like, I think that's a hard truth to swallow. Like, you're going to allow parents to abuse their kids, but you're also going to have kids who commit suicide because they like can't handle the intensity, the social life of school. And we've just, there's no way out of that dilemma, I think.
So I think, you know, a lot of people have theorized and talked about the way that you should think about children's rights or their rights held in trust by adults in their lives, whether it's, you know, their parents or guardians or it's the state. But that then the principle you should sort of apply is that kids should basically people should make decisions for kids with the goal of retaining option value. That like the goal is that when you turn 18 and you gain all the benefits and you are recognized all the rights of a citizen, then at that point, no one should have made a decision prior in your life to have limited the choices and options available to you there. This is like a quite a difficult standard to operationalize. Like I, in principle, I agree with it. And I think it'd be good if like parents are like, okay, if I'm making a decision about whether or not like, you know, my kids should go to school or not go to school. Seems like it's good to send them to school because they'll have more options later to decide they don't want to be educated. But if I don't send them to school, then they're never going to learn to read. They can't make those decisions. But then in some ways it's like, it basically sort of implies that no one should let their kid become like an Olympic athlete. And like no one should ever allow their kid to like, you know, become like a very high specialization in like music and like, or any of these kinds of, difficult skills that
or
you
Amish.
Need to like develop or Amish or yeah or
you
even
can't
any kind of religion
Amish
no yeah. but even any kind
religion
of religion
that's
like,
really
yeah.
separate yeah
exactly and I mean you can even extend it further like sort of like ideological kind of engagement with your kids like at some level you're not going to tell your kids every single form of moral system that exists. You're going to usually impart the one that you believe is correct, and that's going to shape their lives forever. Even if they reject it later on, it will be shaped by those experiences. So it seems like a very difficult dichotomy, but I wonder, like, is this the framework that people should and the government should be using when they're evaluating whether or not parents are hurting their kids?
I mean, that was the longstanding understanding. I mean, that comes sort of from political theory. There's this kind of idea of the open childhood. That should be the goal that you're going for. And when we think about how we should structure education, how we should structure rights, how we should structure like state intervention into families and things like that, that should be what we are aiming at. And, you know, that was kind of like peak Rawlsian liberalism in the 80s and 90s. And I don't think that is the prevalent view anymore. And for the reasons that you mentioned, that like we've had a kind of reevaluation of like what is a good life. And the problem with this kind of open childhood theory, I think, is that its vision of a good life is like going to an Ivy League school and being a professional. And you've got to leave the options open to such a degree that that will always be available to you. Right. And I mean, there's like, you know, political theorists have all kinds of other standards that they raise for determining whether you're pursuing this kind of open childhood. Like, can't, you know, we want to raise children who are going to be able to revise their understanding of the good, et cetera. The kind of life that they're describing is a life of like a kind of transient, you know, highly educated professional who can like decide to convert to Buddhism, go to India for a while and meditate, come back. Like it's like frictionless, right? Mm-hmm. But the reality of life is like, there are costs to, it's like eat, pray, love is really like the vision. That's openness, right? It's like, you can always change. Well, eat, pray, love, like maybe it's a horrible kind of life. and like the costs of destroying your family to like, pursue these sorts of things, right? Of leaving behind your connections, your ties to a place. Like those costs are really high for some people and other people probably just value them less. It's easier for them, but like life is not frictionless in this way. And so I think there's kind of been a sense, especially in the 21st century, as we kind of move away from this kind of Rawlsian vision of liberalism, that like being rooted in a place has value. It like brings mm-hmm. people happiness, right? There are all kinds of jobs that like you don't need to go to college for and are still good. And like there, you can support yourself. You can support your family. There are people who will just enjoy those jobs more because like college is not actually for everyone. It's not mm-hmm. like ideal for everyone. It doesn't make everybody happy and better off. And as we have sort of reconsidered these things, it's like, the question of the Amish, this is like Wisconsin v. Yoder is the famous Supreme Court case about this. Like, can you, you know, give your children an Amish education which would apparently disqualify them from like going to med school, going to law school, right? I mean, they could, it would just be a lot harder for them. It would at least disadvantage them in that pursuit because it would allow them to be Amish. And if they didn't have that education, they actually couldn't be Amish anymore. And is being Amish a viable way of life that we should like be willing to protect? And I think that shift is really good for the most part. I think, you know, we have sort of this understanding now more because college has kind of not panned out as well as we'd hoped, or college for all has not panned out as well as we've hoped. And a lot of the lives that were being sort of idealized by this vision of the open childhood are also themselves coming into question. That like, yeah, parents, you know, they are imparting their way of life. And when we say that they're closing off certain options to their kids, like that's inevitable. And that the kind of like liberal open parenthood itself is a way of life that closes those kids off to ways of life that we just didn't really value that much. Or at least the professors who were writing this political theory from like Yale and Harvard didn't really value that much in the 80s and 90s, right? Like if you have to leave your traditional community, right, and you are going to go be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, like you've been closed off from a way of life that maybe was valuable. Like maybe being Amish was valuable. Being Orthodox Jewish might be valuable, right? And you can only do that if you have the right kind of upbringing for it. And if you don't have the right kind of upbringing, then there's a huge barrier to entry for you to join these communities in the same way that people who have an Amish upbringing or an Orthodox Jewish upbringing now have an extra barrier to entry to become doctors and lawyers. And that was just discounted, I think, in that theorizing about the open childhood, that like the barriers to entry to Amish and Amishness and Orthodox Judaism or any traditional community, they just didn't value those as like a valuable way of life. And so the fact that you created a barrier to entry just didn't count as a cost to them. And I think now we can weigh that better and say like, no, there's costs on both sides. Right. And it's just not obvious which way to go.
I think this is, you know, what you're saying seems right in a broad sense. But I think there are probably specific cases where we can be pretty sure in general, or like very sure in general, that like making the alternative choice is harming your kid. And I think there's like ones, for instance, about like if you are indoctrinating your kid in a view that women are subservient to men, and not just in a maybe like a in a more shallow sense, but like in a sense where like the girls in the family are not allowed to go to school, but the boys are, the girls in the family are not accessing basic educational or, you know, self-reliant tools that they would be able to actually become adults later on, not to the level where you're like actually physically abusing them or anything like that, but they're basically being cut off from ever becoming like a full adult in the way that a boy might be. And there's ways we can imagine these choices being made. Obviously there's like an implementation problem here of like how would you actually adjudicate this, but like it does seem to me like your framework feels like it is going to leave a lot of kids, it feels like it's going to leave a lot more kids to the whims of parents rather than to like more strict standards like we are doing with the age of majority.
I mean, we already leave kids to the whims of their parents to sort of regulate things like how you're teaching, you know, boys and girls about what it means to be a man or a woman. Like that would involve a lot of intense intervention into people's family lives, which we have never done. So that would be the kind of like novelty there. Not so much what we are already doing, which is pretty much leaving children to the whims of their parents, at least about ideology and things like that. I think that it's, again, it's this kind of cost benefit where it's like very clear that if you lean towards one side, you're allowing the extremes of that side, you're licensing them to do bad things to children, right? And in some sense, that's a cost. And the question is, are you going to accept that cost? Because the alternative, which is a lot of state intervention into family life, also comes with equivalently bad costs. I think one way to think about this is like, we have this mainstream culture. In theory, it's pretty potent and attractive. And people from all of these little tiny communities that are like dissenting communities, however we want to sort of conceptualize them, but like dissenting communities, like not that they hate us or anything like that necessarily, but like the Amish, Orthodox Jews, you know, some, you know, the sort of extreme version of Mormonism that's illegal, but like still persists in places where there's not a lot of oversight, right? All kinds of questionable ideologies that people teach their children just even independently of any organized religion or anything like that, right? right? Like, let's call them like dissenting communities, right? So, you know, we, in theory, like, and it has been true through the 20th century that the mainstream attracts people from these dissenting communities. They don't actually grow into enormous threatening blocks. And even though a lot of times they have a lot of kids, so you'd think that they'd be growing, but they're just not growing that fast because a lot of those kids defect. And there's a kind of organic process there where people individually make this choice, right? Like, I have on the one hand this experience in my family, in my community, and then there's this world out there that looks attractive to me for what, you know, various reasons. I have to decide I can't stay in both, right? Mm-hmm. So the strength of mainstream liberal culture, I think you do have to sort of sustain that strength and make it attractive to people so that you can keep the dissenting communities at the fringes of your society without, you know, oppressing the dissenting. You don't really want to go in and coerce these communities. You don't actually, ideally, we want to avoid a situation where we have to disband them, where we have to take their children away, where we have to do these sorts of things, because there's other rights in play there, you know, rights of free exercise and religion that we also value, rights of association and things like that. So we want to create a kind of situation in liberalism where we have these dissenting communities, but they really are on the fringes. And there's some cost to allowing them to stay, but then the cost of invading them, we have to also calculate, right? And are not zero. And so you could get to a situation, however, because this is kind of like left to people's individual choice and we're not really controlling them and we're not even really putting our finger on the scale in any formal way, right? You could get to a situation where these communities like become really numerous, right? Mm-hmm. Become really politically powerful. You know, you could say, for example, this kind of situation is taking place in Israel now with the Haredi, right? You have these ultra-Orthodox religious Jews. They are opposed to the society in a lot of important ways. They're opposed to the mainstream in a lot of important ways. And they are very numerous in ways that allow them to have political power in the Israeli parliament and like make legislation that's favorable to them and allows them to sustain themselves, sometimes at the expense of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. You could get to a situation like that, and that would be really problematic. And then you would have to make a different calculation about whether you want to intervene, whether you want to use the force of the state to coerce these people in various ways. I mean, Israel is trying to do this too. Like, they're trying to get these people to be required to join the military because that's an mm-hmm. important assimilation mechanism in Israeli society. You know, they didn't want to do that for a long time because they're liberal, right? Mm-hmm. Because they want to preserve the rights of these groups. We are like that too. And I think there, again, it's like a calculation, right? We have liberalism on one side and liberalism on the other. And we have to decide, you know, at what point do we want to violate certain liberal rights for the sake of preserving liberalism, right? Preserving our community so that we're not taken over by these people. And how long can we hold out without doing that? And how long can we continue to try to use persuasion and the attractiveness of mainstream, you know, life as the way to sort of keep these people in check?
But I think this is, I mean, this empirical almost question is where I am the most unsure, right? Because this, you're right, there are costs on either side of like whether we want more CPS intervention, which we know can have massive harms to families and to children and to parents and to communities, which in some ways it seems to me can be an investment question and like an implementation problem. But like there's always going to be some level of harm brought when you bring the state into someone's home and to separate families from one another. And then there's the other problem of like not doing that enough if there are children who are actually in harm's way. And I guess it seems to me, maybe I'm reading you wrong, that you think that like the current equilibrium is either reasonably fine or maybe too harsh on families. And to me, it's like I'm feeling like very unsure. Like it seems like very unclear to me like whether or not that's the case.
Yeah, I would say equilibrium is a really good way to think about it, right? Are we in equilibrium, right? Can we sustain ourselves? Can we sustain the sort of, you know, institutions, the constitution, all of the things that are part of the mainstream of our society at this level of, you know, dissent? And I mean, I don't know the answer. You know, I would, you know, having also mostly my education and training came out of this like much more liberally dominant moment where this kind of Rawlsian framework or paradigm of the open childhood was really the prevailing one. And so I'm sort of opposed to that. And I sort of understood myself as like, I'm trying to make an argument that says, no, the open childhood is like not the only good life that there is. It excludes a lot of good lives without really valuing them. But it's true that we're kind of of past that now. And mm-hmm. I don't know where the equilibrium is. I mean, that's why I say, like, we're always, if this is a judgment call, we have to judge, like, when are we in an existential situation where we are willing to go in and violate the religious, the associative rights of these communities so that they don't violate the rights of their children or they mm-hmm. don't harm their children in ways that we find to be unacceptable. And I think that's just a kind of permanent judgment call. But I think the important thing is we see the costs on both sides, that it's not costless for the state to go in and do this, that the state like does a lot of harm when it does it. I mean, the CPS thing is one example. But even just to say, like, we're, you know, once the state is really involved in child rearing, it takes away, you know, things from parents who are benevolent and would do good to their children. They become less able to do that too, because everybody is more regulated by mm-hmm. state intervention.
So there are a couple of specific cases I want to ask you about. Like, one is spanking or physical punishment of children, right? This is a place where we have now pretty good research that indicates that it's bad for kids to physically hit them. And yet, like large numbers of parents think it's completely reasonable to do this. We did some polling here at the argument that we'll link in the show notes that, like, we have more than 40% of parents think it's acceptable to give your kid a good hard spanking when needed. And so, like, this is something where it is just, you know, the research that we have is in direct contention with, like, popular majoritarian preferences to allow this to happen. And this scenario, though, like, I don't know, like, it seems like a very clear-cut case where, like, this is just harming kids to allow this to occur. Yet, even if it does get to a judge does not say, like, well, if you ever laid your hand on a kid, that means that, like, you have abused them. We say, like, no, there's a realm of spanking that we think is okay and not considered harmful. So, I mean, what do you think about this? Like, is this a law? Do you think that the government, it would be good or bad for governments to ban this sort of behavior?
Yeah, well, so it's interesting that you say there's all this research. Like, for 500 years, people have been, you know, philosophers have argued against corporal punishment. Locke argues against corporal punishment. So argues Comenius, a guy nobody has ever read, basically, from the 16th century, argues against corporal punishment. Philosophers love to argue against corporal punishment because when they write these tracts on education, how to educate children, oh, well, you should never beat them because it harms them. That comes from Plato. Plato says, you know, if you hit somebody, you know, you're harming them, you're not making them better. Well, none of those people have ever taught in a classroom. Actually, that's not true. Comenius, I think, did teach in a classroom. But these other people, these philosophers who will tell you that, like, spanking is horrible or corporal punishment in general, horrible. Of course, they've never had to manage more than one child at a time. So the people versus the experts is a really long standing conflict. And the experts go back to the 16th century arguing that, like, obviously you shouldn't be using corporal punishment. And the school teachers are always the ones who are like, yeah, that's a nice thought. Good luck to you.
And sorry, and do you think is this good? Is this in your sense that we allow this?
It's a judgment call whether you should spank your kids. I don't spank my kids. But let's put it this way. If you were the CPS, if you were, let's say, family court judge, and mm-hmm. you saw a case where you had a family, there was no other indication of abuse or neglect, and the only thing that had happened is we know that they spanked the kid, would you take the kid away?
No, but I think that it's less about a judgment call, but whether I think that's, like, good or bad for the kid, which I think it's, like, probably, it's easy to, for me to, like, put money down that's probably bad for the kid, given the psychological research we have on this and developmental research we have on this. But I think it's more because, A, the alternative is much worse, like putting a kid in family.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's exactly what I'm getting at, is when you legislate against it, if we were to pass a law saying no spanking, you as a judge would be obligated to take the child away, right? And you see mm-hmm. that this is, like, maybe not worth raising to that level. Right. So I think that the division that you see in your polling is actually expressive of that ambivalence, which is, like, mm-hmm. we know what real abuse looks like. Like, we only want to intervene when it's really bad, because there are so many costs to intervening. And
you
don't want to
intervene
play
other ways. You could say it's you get fined. You could say there are things you could say that you're not going to, you know. So my question to you is more like, do you think this is an area where our society has been not intervention, it has not intervened enough in the parental rights?
No, I think this is an area where we're still like I mean, this is kind of like all of the things you brought up at the very beginning, gentle parenting, permissive parenting. Like, this is still within the realm of these kind of moral, psychological arguments about what is the best way to raise your children, where we don't penalize people for not being gentle parents or permissive parents or strict parents or whatever other kind of book you just read that told you how to be a parent, right? It's just like you go on mom forums and debate this stuff. That's like in that level of cultural controversy, where it's a controversy and people feel like the stakes are high and they argue about it, but we're not penalizing anybody for making one choice or another. And I think like your hesitation as the, you know, hypothetical judge is pretty indicative of why, because like, mm-hmm. we just don't think it rises to the level where we want to get, you know, we want all of the consequences of state intervention to be unleashed.
Well, Rita, you've alleviated a lot of my concern about future restrictions of rights on my own future kids. So thank you for that. But
yeah, just restrict them.
Yeah, just
entirely.
Do whatever you want.
No, don't do whatever you want. Just they don't do what they want.
They
That's
don't
the key.
Do what they want. Exactly. Always our last and final question. We like to ask, what is an argument that you've come across recently that you disagreed with? This can be a book or an article, a tweet, a parenting advice you've heard, or relationship advice you've heard that you really took issue with.
Oh, I don't know. There's so many. Someone is always wrong on the internet.
Yes.
I'll try to keep it within my wheelhouse so I don't find myself drowning in some depth that I don't know enough about. What's the argument that I've come across? I mean, you go on mom groups. I love mom groups. They're the best thing ever. Like, when you have kids, you should just join all the mom groups, because
yeah.
like there's sociology for you. Like, that's mm-hmm. what's really going on in our society. One thing that I have found interesting, I don't know if I've exactly disagreed with, I have disagreed with what a lot of these people responded to these situations with, but that I found really interesting, which goes back to the sexuality question and the like sexual autonomy question, is like, there's this kind of understanding that like, we want children to explore their sexuality. It's like largely on the left. We want children to explore their sexuality, and we want the schools to teach them sex ed, and we want them to teach them not just like the birds and the bees, but like further, like, you know, about what it means to have sex, like how to explore different ways. We want to give them options. We want to tell them about, you know, LGBT lifestyles and all of these things. Right. And we want to do that because like, we want them to find themselves in a sense, right? So I live in a very progressive community in Chapel Hill, and my kids go to the public schools here. And so I encounter all of these debates. But what I find really interesting is like, when it comes to like students showing each other porn, this has come up in our neighborhood, in our town, mm-hmm. right? Like, what happens when a kid shows another kid porn on their phone or whatever, they're at their house, I mean, not at school, the people are outraged. Like, this person, like, they should be in jail. Like, we should call the cops when a yeah. kid shows another kid porn on their phone. And it's like the same people who think that like there should be sexual exploration and that children should be sort of exposed to these different things like at a young age, so it's normalized, and also so that they can sort of think about whether this is what's going to satisfy them. And I find this contradiction like so bizarre, right? Like, Why would we want to like call the cops on something? The kid is showing this other kid porn, probably because like an older sibling showed them porn. But mm-hmm. they're like, no, this is a sign of abuse. Like, parents need to call the cops. Parents need to like be hauled in, et cetera, et cetera. So what interests me is like, there's still this like deep hesitation about your own kids having sex, having access to sexual material, among people who like in principle would espouse a great freedom to do this for children. And so, I mean, I disagree with the people. It's strange for me because I disagree with the people who say you should call the cops, even mm-hmm. though in general, I don't think we should expose children to like all of this sexual stuff early on. I don't think they're really prepared for it. So I'm like on the more conservative side of that question. But then this idea that like we should like go after them, mm-hmm. I find very bizarre. It's like we're kind of on opposite sides of the same paradox, and neither of us is consistent.
I wonder if sometimes though this is almost a semantic problem that people are drawing, that what they want is people's ability to access romantic expression, but not sexual expression. Like, the knowledge that, you know, your teacher has a male partner or a female partner, or that they are exposed to books where the two penguins are both boys rather than a boy and a girl, like, that's very different than like whether straight or gay sex that they're being exposed to. And I wonder if like people are just bad at drawing these distinctions.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I think there's some like visceral objection to the sexual exposure of their children.
Yeah.
But it somehow conflicts with their ideological embrace of sexual exposure. And mm-hmm. what I find bizarre is, like, even though I don't embrace the exposure, then I'm like, we shouldn't punish the people who are, like, showing, like, they're innocent. They're just, like, some older siblings show them some porn. They don't know what they're doing, right? So that I have found very interesting. And I find, I mean, the whole contradiction, I think, is interesting to me because it gets at something on the left, but it also gets something on the right, because the right is also very obsessed with, like, the purity, you know, not exposing the kids to sexuality. But, like, would you punish a kid, right, who, like, came across this stuff? Like, mm-hmm. you know, so I think, I mean, that would be maybe one example of something I've disagreed with, but I'm kind of also exonerating myself from the disagreement by saying, like, we're all in the wrong here. This just is totally contradictory.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Rita. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.